from the Sky News Centre at 6. It's just been confirmed that Charlie Rowley, who was poisoned by the nerve agent Novichok in Wiltshire, has been released from hospital. He'd been undergoing treatment after he and his partner Dawn Sturgis fell ill last month. She died after coming into contact with the substance. Sam Hobson is among friends gathering in Salisbury today to remember her.
I've organised for anyone to turn up, really, friends and family, to have a drink at the pub and share their thoughts on what's going on and about Dawn and Charlie. Usually this kind of stuff doesn't happen, really, and it's a shame that she's gone. I just want to get everyone together and do a nice thing.
A man who made bombs for the Taliban in Afghanistan and was plotting an attack in Westminster has been jailed for at least 40 years. 28-year-old Khalid Ali was carrying three knives when he was arrested. Four more bodies have been found in a Missouri lake, taking the total killed after a tourist boat capsized to 17. It overturned last night after a severe thunderstorm. Two teenage boys have been sentenced to 10 and 12 years behind bars for plotting a mass shooting at their school in North Yorkshire. The pair plan to target classes in Northallerton. And Sir Tom Jones has pulled out of more concerts this weekend due to illness. That's the latest. I'm Annie Green.
BCFM 93.2.
I'm on BCFM 93.2.
This is Bristol. Steffi for 3 hours of US music. It's Friday, 6 o'clock, and welcome to the BCFM Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling, helping me review this week's news. It's Lib Dem councillor for Knoll, Gary Hopkins. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 7 o'clock news, Trump invites Putin to the White House, invoking screams of impeachment and treason. Why does detente between these two great superpowers annoy former CIA director John Brennan so much? And a new satirical series, What is America?, blatantly stolen from the UK broadcast satirist, the format anyway, Chris Morris, by Ali G, Sacha Baron Cohen. It's made for US audiences, so why is it the best we can come up with being shown on UK TV? Are we not able to produce our own comedy anymore under US media control? And on the week Israel enshrined racial discrimination in law, the secret society, the Pereshim, behind the Zionist movement in America. Shocking research from Alison Weir at If Americans Knew of the infiltration of the US government as far back as the late 19th century by a secret group, a transatlantic arrangement to create a Zionist state, using American political and military power, whether the Jews wanted it or not. That's all in the second hour after seven. On to our news review in a minute, but first Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. This weekend, hot, 26, 27 degrees Celsius, sunny, a few clouds around. Next week, again, generally sunny, but a bit cloudy on Wednesday, around 25 degrees Celsius, only slightly cooler, just a degree or so cooler. Next weekend, 28th and 29th of July, cooling to the low 20s, occasionally cloudy, sunny, but still no rain. That's no rain for another week. That was Bristol's two weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So helping me review this week's news is Lib Dem councillor for Knoll, Gary Hopkins. Hi Gary, welcome to the politics show.
Hi.
Now I know you've been working hard again on a campaign you thought you'd won, but it's now come back to bite you again.
Well, I don't think it's bitten us, but certainly it's potentially very damaging for the bus service.
Well, it must be annoying if you fought and fought and won to keep the bus service and now it's suddenly disappearing again.
Yeah, I mean, basically the problem is that after years of campaigning, powers were given to the Metro Mayor to be able to bring in franchising, as they have in London, to get sensible structure in our bus services.
So has he done that?
No. He's not interested in doing it, and neither is the Bristol mayor. So basically we fall back on a chaos we've actually got now, and Wessex Buses, having put in quite a lot of money invested in the Bristol, have decided it's not an area they want to do business
so
in, and they've pulled out.
Tell us about the 51. Where does it go from and to, and why is it important?
It goes from the South Bristol Hospital, which is very important in itself because there's a lot of particularly elderly people need to be able to get there, through Hengrove and to areas where there's no other bus service, through Knoll, and bits of Knoll which are quite challenged financially, and up to Broadwalk Shopping Centre. And when it was cancelled by First a couple of years ago, there was huge efforts by a lot of the residents. We got a 5,000 signature petition. All the businesses were frantically fighting. And we actually managed to persuade Wessex to come in to run a service. And for 2 years, they've run a service commercially, and it's, you know, it's washing its face. It's not making a huge amount of money, but it's doing okay.
Well, I mean, what Wessex will say to you is it's just not making enough money, Gary.
Well, it's not that individual service. They've actually decided to pull out the area, and they've sold their business to Stagecoach. So basically the subsidised routes Stagecoach are actually going to run. The non-subsidised routes, it doesn't look like they are going to run.
Well, that's funny you mentioned Stagecoach, because I was waiting for a Stagecoach bus on Wednesday this week, and waited and waited and waited. There's only one between Stroud and Cirencester every day at 10 past 12, and no bus at all. And there was a whole bunch of us waiting at the bus stop. So what do we do now? What do you do? Phone Stagecoach. And that's it. That's your day destroyed, effectively, when they don't turn up.
Yeah, I mean, it's slightly different in town because, you know, you do have slightly better alternatives normally. But, you know, without sensible, dependable bus services in Bristol, people will do, which is what they do, turn to having to use their car because they don't trust the bus service. Even if they're working now, they're worried that they won't be working in a few weeks' time. So basically, that's why Bristol has so much congestion, because people can't trust the bus services.
Well, that's good for the people who want a congestion charge. Do you want a congestion charge?
No.
So that seems to be one of the sub-agendas here. Particularly, I mean, I looked at that whole Metro bus project and thought, well, it would be very difficult to dream up any kind of high-end public transport scheme that did so little to actually affect congestion.
Well, if it had been delivered in the way it was originally planned, it would have been working a couple of years ago, and it wouldn't solve all of Bristol's traffic problems, but it would have made a small but useful contribution. As it is, the previous mayor messed around with it and changed design, upped the cost dramatically, and now the present mayor has failed to deliver and is delaying things further and further. And the money that was actually put in, which would have helped to launch the services, has disappeared. So basically South Bristol has actually been abandoned as far as Metrobus is concerned.
Now, as a Labour mayor, you'd expect Marvin Rees to be kicking off about this the whole time. I mean, it's one of the major planks of the Labour Party at the moment, is they want to renationalise public transport, at least the railways. I mean, were we hearing much from the mayor on this?
Well, I think it was in his manifesto, wasn't it? But there was lots of other things in his manifesto that he's got nowhere near actually delivering. So basically, no, we're not hearing anything about it at all. And basically, you know, bus services for people in South Bristol are pretty vital. We do actually have a potential of another new operator coming in that we're speaking to, and I can't say who it is, that we're having discussions with. But the problem is that First, having said 2 years ago that the route is useless, they weren't interested in it at all, they've now tried to register a spoiler service that's running for part of the day and for part of the route, which will be enough.
I mean, if it's profitable, it's better than nothing, isn't it?
Well, slightly better than nothing, but it won't be dependable. They'll take it off when they fancy taking it off. But it's enough to actually put off other people who would come in and run a proper service, because that's what First do. They put in spoiler services. They look to drive other businesses off the road, off their routes. They've done it in Bristol on lots of occasions. I mean,
isn't the long and short of this really that poor areas of the cities, at the end of the day, won't be served by buses simply because they're not profitable enough?
Well, lots
now,
of
we'll have lots of
city.
Nice buses from the centre to Clifton and to Temple Meads, but you know, a lot of the other parts of the cities, the poor areas, won't be served.
Well, it's not just the poor areas, although obviously people there tend to suffer more because they haven't got the luxury of switching to their private vehicle in the way that people in other areas have. But the whole of the city, actually, is having a much poorer service than it should do. I was looking at some stats earlier on in the Bristol Quality of Life Survey. 7 years ago, people were actually reasonably happy with the bus service, though I didn't think it was up to scratch. That number has actually gone down. A third of those people who are reasonably happy with their bus services are now unhappy with it. And it's got worse and worse, and it's a spiral.
What do you put that down to then?
The lack of getting hold of a franchising system.
I mean,
that's what you actually
shouldn't it be under direct control of the local authority?
Yeah. Well, local authority doesn't tend to be particularly good at running some details, but what the local authority should be controlling is what the fares are, where the buses run, and what the timetable is. And that's what a franchising system does. And that's what works in London.
I mean, surely if you're going to have a private operator, there's two extra people taking from the fares as they're being paid by the passengers. One is the fat cat buses, and I can guarantee you all of these big private operators, Stagecoach, whoever it is, First Group, have got plenty of fat cat bosses that take massive salaries, well, and also the shareholders. Well, so, I mean, it's bound to be cheaper, surely, doing it in-house.
Well, let me tell you that the most effective operator in the UK is HCT, and basically they're the biggest not-for-profit company, public enterprise company in the UK.
Well, why
and they run millions of buses, and they actually run buses in Bristol, and they're gradually taking over more of the bus services in Bristol. And that's the sort of company we should be backing.
Well, would they do this Route 5, do you think?
The Route 51, you mean?
51, sorry. Yeah.
Well, we'll have to see, but of course they've got the potential of the spoiler from First. Incidentally, there's a certain chap who's chairman of that company by the name of Vince Cable, who took the job up as chairman when he lost his seat in 2015, and it's one of the jobs that he's kept on since he's been re-elected.
Sorry, for which company?
That's HCT.
Oh, right. OK, well, good old Vince. Let's hope he can take over and help us with our buses. I wonder if he'll bother. We shall see. Let's have a look at... let's just have a look at the sort of comparison, really, between that and what's been going on the trains. Because, I mean, for anyone that's particularly up north, the trains have been awful, but they've been pretty horrendous down here as well. We also had the situation the other weekend. I noticed that First Group was saying, please don't use the train unless you have to, because we haven't got enough staff. Gary, I mean, it's not just buses, is it?
No, it isn't just buses. But at least over the last few years with the trains, there is an increase in usage, a significant increase in usage, which is a positive sign. But, you know, no, the system doesn't work very well at all.
Martin, what's going on here?
What's going on is, well, the railway industry shouldn't have been privatised, and nor should the bus industry. And we're now living with the consequence of stupid things we did 30 years ago, which we shouldn't
have
done.
Can't we just go back on what before, like Brexit?
No, you can't. I mean, the problem with doing stupid stuff is you then become path-dependent on more stupid stuff. And, of course, you've also got to recognise that it's just... I mean, when you mentioned earlier about the spoiler by First Group, that's what's going to happen in an oligopolistic market. There is no free market
in
buses.
The thing is, you've now created a massive lobby to keep things the status quo as they are now.
Well, that's right. That's why you shouldn't allow vested interests like that to take over these kind of
a lot of directors and executives of private transport companies that have got used to having their nice Land Rover Discoveries, or probably even more, and they don't want to be
Other thing is, you haven't got an integrated transport strategy. I mean, do you remember when Prescott said we were going to have an integrated transport strategy?
But if
ago,
local authorities aren't going to be able to subsidise buses, and actually Jeremy Corbyn was big on this on Question Time the other day, surely the only services that are going to be able to run, Martin, are going to be the ones that make a good profit. And that's no.
Basically, with a franchise system, what actually happens is that the profitable routes actually cross-subsidise the routes that are less profitable, and they're a package. You can't just run one or two services, which is what we're actually getting at the moment. You need to move to a situation where there's a package let out, and that the companies run a package, not just the one or two routes that they fancy running.
And anyway, as I said, this came up at Prime Minister's Questions this week.
John Woodcock.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My extraordinary constituents help keep the nation's lights on. They keep us safe by building the Royal Navy submarines, and they deserve a train service which is worthy of the name. So will the Prime Minister get a personal grip on this fiasco, which just this weekend has seen 170 services cancelled across the Northern Network because there was a World Cup game on?
Prime Minister!
Can I say to the Honourable Gentleman that
like him, I believe that constituents deserve a rail service that does actually provide for them and provide for their needs. And I recognise the problems that have been experienced on Northern and, of course, on Govia Thames Link as well. We have given unprecedented powers to Transport for the North and funding to Transport for the North. But the issue that he raises in relation to the World Cup was one that affected other train services as well, because of the way many services operate on their requirements for drivers and relying on volunteers to turn up at weekends. And I think this experience may very well be one which the train operators will want to look at to ensure that in future they can provide the services that constituents need.
Well, I mean, obviously people can, you know, this is where the shoe pinches, isn't it? People are not happy. There weren't enough people turning up. I mean, if you want people to turn up on a World Cup day, you've got to pay them over the odds. And of course, one of the things that's made the train companies, the drivers, for example, have had much more power under privatisation than they ever had under nationalisation. There used to be national bargaining. And of course, what's happened, Aslef in particular, have been able to ratchet up wages for their people because they've got all these different private operators to deal with. And it's just added to the costs, etc.
Now, John Woodcock, you just heard there, he quit this week to sit as an independent MP, quit the Labour Party. As he's saying, the sexual harassment investigation inside the Labour Party is rigged. The resignation letter accuses Jeremy Corbyn of making Labour unfit for office and of posing a clear risk to UK national security. He's a fierce critic of Jeremy Corbyn and he's quit the party. In a resignation letter, he said it was that Mr. Corbyn could not return the party to being the inclusive mainstream progressive force his constituency desperately need. So he's just sort of conflated with this investigation going on in the party to him. So he seems to be saying two things at the same time, really. One, that Jeremy Corbyn is no good as leader, but also that the party isn't able to... do these internal procedures. I mean, there's been a whole load of nonsense talked about anti-Semitism too, some really appalling decisions, like the one we had Mark Wadsworth, that exclusive interview we had with him a few weeks ago.
Well, I mean, those are two separate issues. I mean, Woodcock, basically, by resigning the Labour whip, presumably...
Can I just say, no, it's not... What I just said was that this is the Labour Party's internal disciplinary procedures.
All right, well, OK, so they're both about internal disciplinary procedures, but about two different cases, aren't they? I mean, Woodcock, by resigning the Labour whip, presumably, they can't proceed with the investigation into his texting offensive stuff to people, and that's a way of him getting out of it. And of course, he's always been hostile to the current Labour leadership. And of course, even though the Labour policy now is to retain Trident, you've got to remember that that's Barrow in Furness, which he's the MP for, is where it's based, and there's going to be a vested interest there. Whether we should spend our money on all of this is another matter.
He's also saying that anti-Semitism is being tolerated in the Labour Party.
Well, that's the sort of thing that people on the right like him say, and in actual fact, it's wrong.
There's been actually quite a lot of knife-edge votes in Westminster over the last couple of weeks, Gary, hasn't there? And a Labour MP resigning the whip and resigning from the party can tip things one way or the other.
Well, I don't suppose he's changing his views on Brexit, whatever they are, and it doesn't sound like he would pay much attention to what the leadership tell him. But what is very concerning is that Labour MPs have been keeping the present government in power, which is very, very concerning, very, very damaging. And the Tories have in actual fact been, you know, cheating, as it were, in terms of having arrangements to pair MPs so that our deputy leader, who was at home following having a baby, was supposed to be paired with the chairman of the Conservative Party, and then he went and voted.
So the pairing, let's just explain this. The idea of pairing is that you agree, two sides of a vote agree that one person on one side won't turn up and the other person on the other side won't turn up because they've, you know, obviously there's all party whips are being told, look, it's going to be really difficult for me to make this vote. And so they can actually arrange to allow people to be away from the House of Commons, doing important talks, doing childcare, whatever it happens to be.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, basically, it sounds a bit boring to the general public, but actually it's extremely important for things to be able to function. We've got some very old-fashioned rules about them having to be there at certain times and vote in certain ways. That should be modernised, but in the meantime, until it is, there's got to be trust between the parties, and I'm afraid that the Conservative chief whip just has to be sacked, because nobody now can ever trust him. There were several members of his own party who he instructed to vote despite the fact that they were paired, and fair play to some of them, they actually refused to do it. They said, no, we've made an agreement and we're sticking to
it. Well, they'll say it all's fair in love and war. This is a very important battle we're fighting here against the Lib Dems.
Well, I mean, you know, there's all sorts of wars, but hopefully we stick by the Geneva Convention, which happens to be quite important. And the same sort of thing actually happens, you know, in votes in Parliament. If you can't trust people to stick to agreements, you're going to have chaos.
Martin, this has been precipitated by the last couple of weeks of pretty horrific knife edge votes over Brexit, one of which, as in fact several of which, have been to do with this Irish border issue, which you get very heated about. Do you think you have accepted that there will have to be an Irish border now? After all, we've got Britain as Northern Ireland is part of Britain, and that's going to have Brexit, whereas the Republic isn't. And I know you're very wedded to the idea of the Irish nationalist cause, but it doesn't look as if there is any alternative to having a border there.
What will happen, they've already agreed, the British government have already agreed with the EU, a fallback position, and don't forget the DUP were involved in this, that if there is no agreement, and of course we could always stop the process and slow it down, but if there's no agreement, then the regulatory regime in the six counties will stay the same as in the 26 counties. And don't forget, in the six counties, the majority has voted to remain inside the EU. The DUP didn't vote for it, but they didn't win.
Well, we did in Bristol, but we're not going to get
a separate deal. But you've basically got joint sovereign.
Are we going to have a separate deal in Bristol?
No, but Northern Ireland isn't Bristol. Ireland is a separate state, and there's a question of whether if there was a vote in the whole of Ireland, do you think they would vote to leave the EU?
Well, the Channel Islands is a separate island.
No, yes, so they're not even in the
Gibraltar
EU at all.
Gibraltar is separate.
No, anyway, listen, if you were talking about the Irish border, what will happen as a result of this? It'll be a deal breaker. If they aren't prepared to make that, it's been made clear quite clearly by the EU, and of course then they're representing the Dublin government, that if you're not prepared to accept this, we're not moving on to discussing anything else. So we are going to have a hard Brexit, as the WTO is being
savage. It will be a no-deal Brexit.
It'll be a no-deal Brexit.
Well, will it?
Well, you might actually get to a situation at that point where the government falls and we have a general election,
Gary,
and the people doing the negotiation are the same people.
Gary.
I just don't know what's going to happen there, but I don't think there's a majority in the House of Commons for a no-deal Brexit. And if we get to that position where it's WTO or nothing, I think that Parliament might actually vote to pull back, because it would be so disastrous that, you know, I don't think the government could survive it. So I think there's a possibility,
well,
still a pullback.
One of the things about all this, everyone says exactly that, and one thing you can get everyone to agree on Brexit is that the media coverage of the issues during the debate was appalling. Diabolical, I've heard it's called, because they weren't going into any of these issues which are now coming out now. I suppose you could say we have the benefit of hindsight. But whilst we're on the subject of how terrible the British media is, I mean, they're very, very low down. We might hear, maybe we can bring up that clip from John Cleese on Newsnight, who was saying he's leaving the country because the British media is so full of lies and trivia. I love that, lies and trivia. He's absolutely right. One other thing we didn't get any coverage of whatsoever this week is a very important anniversary, and that is the death of the government scientist, Dr. David Kelly. 15 years of doubts. Miles Goslett was interviewed on one website called Conservative Woman, not in any of the newspapers, any coverage of this whatsoever. I mean, it's covered back in April a little bit when Miles Goslett's book on David Kelly came out and the death of Dr. David Kelly. You may remember he was the government scientist who supposedly, anyway, spoke to the BBC reporter Andrew Gilligan and said, well, actually, this dossier is a dodgy dossier. It's been sexed up. So he was really the whistleblower that there was no weapons of mass destruction and the whole war was based on lies by the intelligence services. That's MI6 and the CIA mainly. John Scarlett was in charge of MI6 at the time, I seem to remember. But anyway, let's have a little listen now to Miles Goslett, who's just written this new book. It's called An Inconvenient Death, How the Establishment Covered Up the David Kelly Affair. And here he is speaking on the George Galloway Show on LBC. Haven't heard anything of him on the BBC, funnily enough.
it's vital that everyone listening and everyone who reads this book, you know, remembers David Kelly was denied a coroner's inquest. On that basis, what I say in the book repeatedly is that, you know, he deserves a coroner's inquest. There must be a coroner's inquest because I believe that a coroner is the only person who can determine how, where, and when David Kelly died. So, as I say, I conclude that he didn't take his own life in the manner officially found by Lord Hutton, who chaired a public inquiry into his death, which replaced the coroner's inquest, but that a coroner must be given an opportunity to determine, you know, the sort of final result, as it were.
Well, I think that's incontrovertible, isn't it? Why was there no coroner's inquest? If there's nothing to hide, you have a coroner's inquest and you find out how he died.
Can you say something a little bit about the implications of his death at the time? Because it would have been rather explosive if there had been evidence from such a senior source across the British media that the intelligence services had simply been lying in order to start a war.
Yes, and therefore they become suspects. If he was murdered, they become suspects.
And was it an illegal war, the Iraq invasion? I think many people say it was.
I think the illegal... I think Elizabeth Warren resigned from as deputy attorney general, and it was
Charlie Falconer.
Yeah, who said it was legal, but in actual fact it wasn't, because of course you've got to have a UN Security Council resolution, or you've got to be under immediate attack. And neither of those conditions were fulfilled, so it was illegal.
There was an extraordinary 70-year embargo on the scientific papers that Hutton used to draw his conclusions. Who knows? He could be lying. No one would ever know. And so
he's still not a coroner, is he?
Miles Goslett. No, Miles Goslett mentioned this 70-year embargo too.
Lord Hutton, I discovered in 2010. Thanks to the accidental revelation of a local government official, he determined that all medical and scientific papers and photographs connected to this case would be embargoed for 70 years. That means that then they will not be able to be viewed by the public until 2074. I'll be gone by then. I did ask the then Oxfordshire coroner Nicholas Gardner about the embargo of the papers, and he said to me it was Lord Hutton's intention that everyone should be dead by the time they could be viewed by the public.
Well, I mean, this smells fishy, doesn't it? I can smell a fish in. I can smell fish in here. Can you smell fish? And of course, there's a doctor whose name I've forgotten who's pursued this case pretty comprehensively. The medical evidence that he killed himself is thin to non-existent. You don't die by slashing your own wrists like that.
Finally, let's have a listen to Blair and his role in the cover-up.
David Kelly's body was found officially at about 9:15 on a Friday morning, the 18th of July 2003, in a wood in Oxfordshire. At that time, Tony Blair was on a 14-hour flight between Washington, D.C. and Tokyo when the body was found. Now, Blair has made it clear that during that journey, he was woken by an official and told that David Kelly's body had been found, and it was a case of, quote, suspected suicide. Blair immediately instructed Lord Falconer, as I've said, the then Lord Chancellor, his former flatmate, immediately instructed him to set up a public inquiry. At about 10 o'clock London time, that call was made between Blair and Falconer. And at midday, less than 3 hours after Dr. Kelly's body was found, therefore, Hutton was appointed as chairman. Now, when you consider the speed with which events were moving, when you consider that the body hadn't actually been officially identified by midday and that no medical professional had examined it by midday, it does look very suspiciously as though someone had some advance warning of Dr. Kelly's death.
Yes, it certainly does. I wonder if Tony Blair can be made to testify on this, using some of the evidence which has been buried for 70 years. Maybe not. Gary, what do you make of this? Because I know one of the Lib Dem ministers, I think he was Home Secretary Was he Home Secretary, or maybe he was a
junior in that department?
Junior Home Secretary. He actually wrote a book all about the death of David Kelly.
Yeah, I mean, basically, it was absolutely obvious to anybody who thought about the situation that the government was making up threats which were non-existent. And the reason they were doing that, there was no way they were going to get the resolution through the United Nations. And the only way, therefore, they could give themselves an excuse was to say that we were being threatened. And it was effectively self-defence, the attack, which it clearly wasn't. I think it's extremely likely that Hutton was murdered. And I think...
Oh, no, David Kelly.
Sorry, yes.
Hutton apparently is still with us.
Sorry, my apologies. David Kelly was actually murdered. And I don't know now whether the physical evidence is there for a coroner to be able to do his job effectively. But he certainly should have been given the opportunity at the time. And, you know, as Martin says, it smells to high heaven. But things have passed on now, haven't they? I mean, we know that it was an illegal war. We know that Blair lied about so many different things. And it cost him his place in history because actually, you know, a lot of domestic stuff, he'd done a half reasonable job. But the Labour Party, I'm afraid, were craven. They actually believed what he was saying, or they pretended to believe what was they were actually being told. And they all voted, as did the Tories, gung-ho, let's get into this. And I'm very, very proud.
Not all,
but... large percentage, yeah. Very large percentage.
The book, yeah. The book is called...
And I'm very glad that my party stood out against that in a very principled way.
The book is called The Strange Death of David Kelly. It's by Norman Baker MP, who was in the coalition government as a senior minister in the Home Office. Martin, this is going to run and run, actually, isn't it? I mean, it's one of those things that just will not go away, because David Kelly particularly was a very, very senior military, scientific, civil servant who'd been involved in all sorts of things. In fact, he'd been on trips with Prime Minister David Cameron before he even became an MP.
He went with David Cameron and Sir Kenneth Warren to visit South Africa in about 2000, and they were negotiating with Arms Corps about nuclear weapons in South Africa, but that's another story. I mean, David Kelly was deeply involved in all of this stuff, and he said, I'm going to end up dead in the woods. He said that, and of course he did.
Was he simply the man who knew too much then?
Yeah, I mean, he was just a very high-level person who knew far too much, and of course he could have easily put the lie to what was being said.
I wonder what he would have made of this Novichok Skripal scandal, because he was based at Portendown, wasn't
he? Yes. Well, that's another story. But, I mean, the fact is, when something like this happens, you've got to accept that the British intelligence services lie, cheat, steal and murder. Nobody in Northern Ireland believes anything else. But, of course, Middle England... lives in Middle England's little dream.
Okay, back to Brexit, because it's been a big couple of weeks actually, and Jeremy Corbyn brought it up at Prime Minister's Questions on Wednesday, unsurprisingly.
Jeremy Corbyn!
She obviously forgot, Mr. Speaker, the question I just asked her, which was about the Brexit Secretary's support or otherwise for the European Convention on Human Rights, because he's on record of saying, I don't support the Human Rights Act and I don't believe in economic and social rights. He is obviously backsliding to keep his job, or that is the new policy of the government. With only 3 months to go until the final withdrawal agreement is due to be signed, the Brexit Secretary's resigned, the white paper's in tatters, the new Brexit Secretary's skipping negotiations, 2 years of negotiations with themselves, and they wanted to shut down Parliament for 5 days. They've even given up on negotiating with each other. Isn't the case that the government is failing to negotiate Brexit? Failing to meet the needs of the country because they are too busy, far too busy, fighting each other.
Prime Minister!
Let me tell the Right Honourable Gentleman what I've been doing over the last week. And perhaps let me... And let me also look at what the Right Honourable Gentleman has been doing over the last week. Well, I was agreeing the future of NATO with President Trump. He was joining a protest march against him. Well, I was delivering a plan for our future trade with the EU. He was delivering a plan to teach children how to go on strike. And while I was negotiating our future security relationship with Europe, he was renegotiating the definition of anti-Semitism. He protests, I deliver.
And that was a pretty rumptious session. Gary, what do you... I mean, we've already spoken a bit about this, but do you think... I mean, Jeremy Corbyn's putting up a pretty good fight there, isn't he?
Well, it's about time that he actually did something. I mean, if there's anything that's been almost as bad as the Conservatives in terms of a mess on this, it's been the Labour Party. I mean, they're all over the place. I mean, locally, we got the Bristol West MP, got elected with a massive majority to actually, you know, defend against Brexit, as people thought. And now she's one of the whips that has actually taken the Labour Party down the road of supporting Brexit. I'm sorry, but, you know, the hypocrisy.
Well, yeah, but I mean, surely, I mean, a lot of MPs have said this, Gary. They said, well, we don't necessarily agree with the vote. In fact, Theresa May herself said this. We don't necessarily agree with what happened at the referendum, but the people have made a decision. We are their servants. I mean, there's an attitude of some politicians, isn't it, that we don't care what people think.
We're
going to do what we want anyway.
That's a distraction, because basically, if you look now at the polls, and there's a poll done every month by Comrades, they actually show a very, very definite move to people saying a mistake was made. And there's a much bigger majority now of people who say there was a mistake made than there was a majority at the time for Brexit. And basically, I don't know how it's going to come out. I don't know what particular car crash is going to be negotiated. But at the end of it, the British people ought to have the right to say we like this or we don't like this. Because bluntly at the moment, that excuse of the people told us is absolute nonsense. Does that mean, oh, well, we had a general election in 2017. We don't ever need to have another one. We don't allow people to actually look at the facts and decide which way they want to go. In fact, this wouldn't be a second referendum. It'd be the first one when people can actually see the facts. But it would be the third one in total, because the Brexiteers spent 40 years objecting to the referendum that took place in the 70s.
There was an overwhelming majority. Big overspend, wasn't there, by vote leave? But there were various people pointing out that actually around about twice the amount of money that was spent on the leave campaign than was spent on the remain campaign.
But both campaigns were appalling. Both campaigns had lies involved in them. And I think that's the problem, that the public just said, we don't believe anybody here. We're excluded from the way things are actually going, and they protested. So a reasonable percentage of the Brexit vote was people understandably just protesting.
I mean, this is the problem for people like you, Gary, is actually what you're essentially saying is, oh, well, the people weren't smart enough, they got it wrong.
No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying that people were not given a lot of information, they were misled, and I'm saying... Yes,
they're surely misled on both sides, surely.
There certainly was. And what I'm saying is, when people know what the real situation is, which we will know within a few months what that real situation is.
I mean, have you ever known an election where people weren't misled?
Well, in a few months' time, when people have actually can see for themselves, rather than being lied to by various politicians, what the real situation is, then they should be given the chance to decide what happens. Because Parliament certainly isn't going to sort it out in its present mess, is it?
Well, we have a new Brexit secretary, and it was quite worrying to hear that he has spoken out against the European Court of Human Rights, which is separate to the EU. So we're not going to be leaving the European Court of Human Rights, except Dominic Raab, maybe... Under him, we will, because he's said things against it. So let's have a kind of, I suppose, what you should call a last listen to the former Brexit Secretary, David Davis. He didn't give a resignation speech, but he did have a few things to say about some of his experiences this week in the Commons on dealing with the EU, which I thought was quite interesting.
The European Union is a slow and not very effective negotiator of free trade agreements. We keep hearing about their negotiating power, their size. Actually, the fact that they represent 28 different countries means they come up with suboptimal outcomes all the time. And actually, we're the country that does least well out of the European Union's free trade agreements. They almost never involve services, for example, our primary trade. So the EU is slow, it's not very effective negotiating trade deals. But we will be smaller, of course. But many, many countries that are smaller than us do very, very good trade deals. Switzerland's a very obvious example, and it's much more effective than ours. We're bigger, remember, by the way, when we talk about how small we are, we're bigger than the bottom 18 European countries put together, so we're not small by any normal measure of the word. We also have huge advantages over and above our economic weight. We have the English language, we have English law, we're leaders in life sciences, artificial intelligence, internet, medicine, a whole series of areas, and we are one of the leading countries in terms of intellectual exports. Services encompasses intellectual exports, and in that, the English language is the most powerful weapon possible. Yeah. So what this proposal would do is try and deal with a problem which is less bad than they think, and try and in doing so, throw away a power, throw away a right, which is incredibly important, much, much more important, they think. They are trying to defend a false past and giving up a real future. There we go. Yeah.
Martin, what do you want to make of what he said there? I mean, he's saying effectively, look, this Chequers agreement was about a kind of half-baked customs union, and the general election last year was fought on, we won't be in the customs union.
Well, I mean, there may be another general election which customs unions will feature.
What about the whole sort of aspect of... I mean, Gary was talking about the car crash. We've been talking about crashes on this show for probably the last 10 years. Certainly the economists say that the bubble at some point is going to go bang. Do you think Brexit will precipitate it going bang?
It's possible, because Britain, as he pointed out, is quite a large economy.
I mean, that bubble
If we go into a Brexit recession, which is possible, don't forget, most people have forgotten that the day after the vote, Mark Carney put £250 billion of quick QE into the system to keep the show on the road.
Yeah, but it's not just Mark Carney and the pound, is it? It's also the euro, the dollar. This is a much bigger thing than just the UK.
Of course it is, but the point is that there wasn't the pound lost about 20% of its value, which of course then fed through into squeezes on real wages, etc. And in actual fact, you know, Britain has actually suffered as a result. I mean, you know, if your currency goes down by 20%, you're 20% poorer. But of course, that was offset by quantitative easing, which most people don't understand, which is basically just kicking the can down the road. And if it does turn into a car crash, there's going to be a run on the pound, and then they'll have to raise interest rates, and then the property market will collapse.
Okay, another big story this week is the Cliff Richard judgment, he's been awarded £200,000 roughly, and I'd see if I could track down one of the journalists who really knows a lot about these and freedom of information requests as well. I've been finding out a great deal about what the police powers are, etc. So I spoke a couple of days ago, on the day of the judgment, to Mark Watts, and here he answers some of my questions about what is the actual detail of this judgment, privacy judgment, because quite obviously the legal costs are massive. It's a private prosecution, it's a civil case against the BBC.
My name is Mark Watts. I'm a freelance journalist. I'm the former editor of XRO, and I'm the coordinator at the FOIA Centre. So this is the judgment in the case that Sir Cliff Richard brought against the BBC and South Yorkshire Police. And the judgment that's been handed down today by Justice Mann basically represents a huge boost for Britain's culture of secrecy. Now, we're already notorious around the world for our culture of secrecy, but that's just got a whole lot worse. And the judgment represents a big setback for freedom of expression. What this case is essentially about comes down to a balance or a battle between everyone's Article 8 rights under the European Convention on Human Rights, Article 8 being the right to privacy, and our Article 10 rights, the freedom of expression. Now, the judgment talks an awful lot about the Article 8 rights that everyone has and that Sir Cliff Richard has, but it says very, very little about our Article 10 rights. And this is a huge development of privacy law in this country, which has slowly been developing judge-made privacy law over the past few years. But this is a major step forward in that development, or step backwards, depending on which way you look at it, where Article 8 rights to privacy utterly trample over Article 10 rights to the extent that the judge, just to my mind, has really not weighed them into the balance.
Cliff Richard is quite privileged in that he's spent quite a lot of money. He's a wealthy man. Does this mean that privacy is something that really is only going to be afforded to the wealthy?
Basically, yes. In this developing law of privacy rights developed by judges in various judgments that have been handed down in this country, that's really only an option for anyone who has the resources to bring such actions. So specifically here, this was obviously a case in which the BBC had reported that Sir Cliff Richard's home had been raided in connection with an investigation into child sexual abuse. Of course, that case ultimately didn't go anywhere. A file was sent to the CPS, but no charges were brought. He had never been arrested. And the battle was over whether the BBC had the right to report that or not. In essence, the judgment says no, they didn't have the right, and indeed it was a breach of Cliff Richard's privacy to report it. It wasn't just the judge put it, a rather sensationalist way in which the BBC reported it, such as sending up a helicopter and shooting through the window of his home. That was rather over the top. But actually what the judge is saying is, put all that aside, all this extra sensationalism, as he describes it, put all that aside, he says that even simply to have reported in a very, very, as it were, almost boring way, a very flat way, that his home had been raided, was in itself a breach of privacy. As I say, this is a massive blow for freedom of expression in this country. It's going to be very hard to hold power to account, not something that the media has been very successful at.
I mean, is it fair, though, Mark, to put somebody on the main news to discuss whether or they're actually being investigated when they may have done nothing wrong?
Well, of course, they may have done nothing wrong, and what is critically important is that reporting makes no presumption about guilt, and is indeed very careful to report the response of the person concerned. And actually, if you look back at the reports that the BBC did, it was very careful not to presume guilt, and indeed to allow Cliff Richard, his response. They were possibly a little slow in getting the response, and as I recall, it wasn't there in their very first bulletin. They produced a response about an hour later. So the question is whether it's fair to report that someone is under criminal investigation, so long as they're careful to avoid implying guilt. And I think that's it's a basic right to be able to report that, so long as it's being reported accurately. And actually the judge points out that the reports were accurate, it's just that he didn't like them.
What about the costs? Because Cliff Richard has spent quite a lot of money. Do we know how much on this?
Well, that's not referred to in the judgment, but I think there have been reports of Cliff Richard spending in the order, I think, between 3 and 4 million on lawyers following the BBC report. What the judgment actually does today is it made a determination that he should receive £190,000 by way of general damages, £20,000 for aggravated damages. That was specifically because the BBC had entered the story into Scoop of the Year for the RTS Awards, World Television Society Awards. But there's another strand, which is what's known as special damages, which are for specific things, specific effects, such as having to pay for lawyers to deal with further stories that surfaced in the media, to sort of firefight those, as well as cancelled plans to publish a new edition of his autobiography. Those special damages will add a whole load more to the bill, and then, of course, there'll be legal costs on top. I do think, though, that it's inevitable that the BBC will appeal. They certainly should appeal, in my view. They so far said they're considering an appeal. And actually, I can see this going all the way up the court system in our country and onto the European Court of Human Rights. And actually, I think, in the end, this case really be won by the BBC and the European Court of Human Rights, because I just don't think judges in this country, they, one, don't like the media very much. They certainly don't like the media doing their job at all. And as this judgment shows, for anyone who reads it, is a huge amount of weight is placed on Article 8, the right to privacy, and very, very little weight is taken into account in regard to Article 10.
The right to privacy versus freedom of expression, Gary, what do you think?
Well, I mean, I'm less concerned about, you know, millionaire pop stars than I am about the ordinary man in the street, who actually sometimes can suffer terrible consequences for being falsely accused. And we got to bear in mind that on some offences which they're accused of, there have been lots of instances recently where people have been accused of extremely serious offences, and the evidence which would acquit them has actually been hidden by the Crown Prosecution Service because of poor disclosure. Now, basically, doesn't it add insult to injury that their name is going to be spread around or potentially spread around in the papers when they've done absolutely nothing wrong?
But yes, the name can be spread around, but then that is not, I mean, as he said there, Mark said, that the BBC haven't accused Cliff Richard of doing anything. What they're saying is there is a raid on his home and that there may possibly at some point in the future be charges. But they're being very careful. They're also making sure that they give his point of view as well. So that is to avoid a case for defamation, libel, you know. So they're actually staying within the law, but now they're saying that law is not enough. You're not allowed to report.
I saw that BBC coverage and it was sensationalist, and basically it was meant to get the message across, and there's no smoke without fire. And basically, that's the danger all the time. Even if you know perfectly well that it's perfectly easy to write an article in the paper which is legal, but actually is absolutely damning and gives a completely false impression.
There have been some quite credible accusations against Cliff Richard over the years, Martin, on and off. And also, I wonder whether this particular case is maybe not just about Cliff, but about the accusations against people like Harvey Proctor and Lord Bramall, who have been interviewed by the police. And the idea really being to, even if you're wrongly or rightly accused, to make sure that there is no coverage whatsoever of that sort of investigation going on and the possibility that somebody might be. Because, of course, one of the positive things about that, from the public's point of view, is that if there are other witnesses, they may well come forward to the police.
Yeah, I wonder if everybody would be happy if Jimmy Savile had been raided and the BBC hadn't reported it, and of course they covered up for him for years, didn't they? The other thing that occurred to me is, of course, if somebody on social media had got their phone out and taken a picture of the police doing the raid and then blogged away with, oh, the police are raiding the Cliff Richard's home, which no doubt could easily happen, could they be prosecuted for reporting stuff that they've seen?
I saw a lawyer the other day who made a very, very valid point on this. And basically what he was actually saying is there should be an application to the court to be able to report. And I take the point that sometimes you've got people who are guilty of sexual offences, and publicising that can actually help others to come forward. That's very important.
My view on this is basically that it's more rich and powerful people saying we don't want anything nasty written about us. It's a bit like the right to be forgotten, where you can get your any former misdemeanours removed from the internet, that sort of thing. But anyway, look, one of the most important things with all this child sexual abuse stuff is accusations, is whether you go to the police. And I had a chat earlier this week with a chap that deals, he's actually doing a tour around Scotland at the moment. His name's David Scott and he's from something called the Fresh Start Foundation, and here's his views on whether you can just simply take your accusations to the police or not.
Oh, you've got to be so careful. I mean, this is the huge difficulty. There is no general advice, but what I would say is that people have to be extremely careful. They have to not trust the authorities. They have to weigh up the risks that they're running at every stage, and they have to take responsibility for whatever they do themselves. Let me sort of illustrate this by going back to how one of the charities that we work with, who have been dealing with this for years, they started off advising people to go to the police. This is the charity who deals with the ritual abuse victims. And what they were finding is that it was often young women who were trying to escape abusive situations, and they were trying to report the abuse which had happened, and they very often had children. And the first thing that would happen is the authorities would seize their children. And the second thing that would happen is the authorities would give the children to one of the people they had named as an abuser. And this happened over and over and over again. And it got so that the charity no longer advises. And they met lots of good police officers during this point who were trying to do a good job, and then saw these investigations, if they did get started in a positive way, sabotaged from on high within police ranks. Officers would be reassigned and hostile officers would come in their place and this sort of thing. So it got to the situation that the charity now advises the people, if they're being abused, have you got somebody you trust? Have you got somewhere to you can run to and you can be safe? And if the answer is yes, the advice is get the kids and go. You don't tell the authorities and you don't tell anyone else. Get the kids and go. So the first thing I would say to any survivor who's trying to decide what to do is you have to make sure that you're safe. And ultimately, your safety and survival comes first. I'm afraid that my conclusion is you cannot trust the authorities. You should not trust the authorities. It's too dangerous. You could be fortunate. You could be very unfortunate. You wouldn't know.
Martin, this is the experience of quite a few people over the years. One would hope that the Savile case has meant that the police can be trusted a bit more, but it's not as simple as that all the time.
Well, we had did we not have an interview with the former Met officer that was dealing with
John Wedger, John Wedger, if you want to look
and
him up.
He gave a pretty horrifying account of what happened to him when he tried to investigate these things, and how he was told to back off, and it was more than his job was worth, etc. And then he lost his job pursuing all of these
cases.
What's
at the back of all this, then?
Well, basically, abuse of children has been going on for years and years and years, and it happens all the time. I mean, hundreds of kids in this country die every year from...
Here's a key question. Is this something that Britain has got that other countries don't have, or is it just that Britain is the only country that's really dealing with it at the moment?
No, well, underlying all of this, if I mention the King Cora Boys Home in Belfast, you will understand that why top-level people are protected is it's being used as blackmail by the intelligence services. They probably murdered David Kelly, and they use sexual entrapment as blackmail. That's what was happening at King Cora. Everybody in Belfast knows it.
I mean, isn't it just the mafia, prostitution, organised crime?
No, it's the police and the intelligence services using, but that's what King Cora, MI5 were using King Cora, but various political figures went in there, had sex with underage boys, and then they were being blackmailed.
Gary,
that's what was going on.
A couple of words from you?
I think that we've got to make certain that we don't get extreme on either side, because for a long time victims and survivors were not believed at all, and then we were told you believe everything they say, which was also wrong.
Okay, time for the Murdoch News. Got to stop you there. Time for the Murdoch News. Thanks to our guest Lib Dem Councillor for Noel, Gary Hopkins. Join us after the news as we look at the global picture.
Online and on your mobile, BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.